Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Two guests this week, but I think you're going to enjoy the conversations. First up, Marty Smith. He is the college football reporter, as well as the solo host of Marty Smith's America, which you can catch this Friday on ESPN2 at 7 p.m. That is an interview show where Marty Smith goes out and does long-form interviews, in this case with the Thunder star Paul George and the WNBA star Elena Delladon. Marty Smith is a unique figure at ESPN, as he will say, just given his own accent, given that he is a prominent Southern voice on that network, and has an interesting background in that his background is NASCAR. And ESPN, of course, lost the NASCAR package, and Marty Smith had to figure out what he was going to do with his career. So this is an interesting conversation with, in my opinion, one of the more interesting on-air talents at ESPN, and I think you're going to enjoy it. We go for about 50 minutes or so. Then that's followed by John Orand of the Sports Business Daily and Journal, and he had a really, really interesting piece where he took you inside ESPN as to why that deal between ESPN and Barstool broke up and why John Skipper, the president of ESPN, canceled the Barstool Van Talk show after just one episode. So a conversation for about 25 minutes on John's reporting, where John pretty much went in-depth inside ESPN's conference rooms as to why that there was a dissolution there in that partnership. Marty Smith first, then John Orand, coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, as we said at the top, we start off with Marty Smith, who has been with ESPN since 2006. As I mentioned at the top, Marty Smith's America is the show you want to check out. That show comes out this Friday as we're taping this, so that'd be November 3rd. People will listen to this after November 3rd, and I imagine you'll be able to check that out on ESPN.com, at least some of the clips. Marty Smith joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Marty, thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you having me, brother. I told you before we came on that I just really appreciate the work you do on this podcast, and I learn a lot about my colleagues. Don't tell them, but I find them all very interesting. let's not let that get out.
Yeah, some of them are interesting. I'll give you that, Marty. I'll go that far. So here's one of the things I want to start with. People at ESPN, who I've talked to over the years in-house, really like you and appreciate you. I'm not going to bullshit you here. And the reason they do is because they say you are genuine. You are not a bullshit artist. You are who you are. No apologies at all. And so I want to use that as a jumping off point, because when I've talked to you in the past, and I've written this and I've said this to you, you are an anomaly at ESPN from, as you, in your own words, your full-blown Appalachian Southern accent, to yep. how I would describe you as a human energy drink when you are on screen. So I want to know, how unique do you think you are in major sports television? Because I do not see a lot of people, at least stylistically, who are like you.
Very unique. And I think, first of all, that accent is certainly unique, because there's just not a lot of people with a Southern accent who even get the chance. A lot of folks with Southern accents are asked to go to school and try to quell them. Hmm. I can remember when that became really apparent to me. I was at Bristol Motor Speedway covering a NASCAR race in 2007, and it was August. And I was doing a report about Dale Earnhardt Jr. leaving the team that his father founded, Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, to join Hendrick Motorsports, kind of the New York Yankees, as it were, of NASCAR. And it was a huge story, just a massive story. And this was on the pre-race show, the NASCAR countdown show that I was doing this report. So I get done, and I walk back to the media room, and I sit down, and I get a phone call from Wendy Nix. And Wendy, of course, is an amazing person, hosts NFL Live every day. And Wendy is from South Carolina. And her message to me was, don't lose that accent. I had not met Wendy, never met her. Hmm. And she said, don't lose that accent. She said, it's going to benefit you. She said, you have an opportunity to use that accent to stand out. And I found that to be so interesting because I'd never considered it. But you just don't hear a whole lot of guys like me who have those long eyes like that. And it'd be celebrated. I've been really fortunate, Richard, because it's been celebrated. Nobody has ever told me to change anything I do. And as you know, bro, in this business, that doesn't happen very often.
Do you think that you will serve at all as a forerunner for other Southern or very Southern broadcasters who are maybe in college right now, who want to go into sports broadcasting, who have, you know, who sound like you, who speak like you, but other than you, they don't necessarily hear a lot of people sounding like that on either FS1 or ESPN. I wonder if, I don't know, do you hear from students at Southern schools who say, hey, you know what, like, I appreciate you're on the air because I don't see anybody else who sounds like you?
Every Saturday I'm in the South. Yes, I do. And I think it is inspirational to some of those young people who have talent and drive and passion and desire and a vision for what they want to be. But look, I've said this to you before when you wrote about Marty Smith's America. I am, you know, in a beach full of sand that is made up of grains of sand in this industry. I am like that teeniest, tiniest one. And I make that very clear to anyone. I was just talking to a kid today. I met a young man today who was a very accomplished basketball player in Brazil. And he wants to chase sports media. And his parents asked if I would meet with him. And I did. And I was really fascinated with his passion. And he's like, man, I just want to get there. And I said, don't lose sight of the fact that it is a very difficult climb. It's a ruthless business. People come at you from every angle and they say the most ridiculous, unkind things to you. So you better have some thick skin, but I'm here to help you because I can tell you have the passion. And I say that same thing to those young kids at Alabama and at Clemson and at Florida State and at Georgia and all of these schools that have Southern-born students in their journalism departments. And they can. Anybody can make it if I can make it. That ain't lip service, dude. I mean it. I'm from a farm in a tiny town in nowhere, Virginia. And somehow I have the blessing of covering college football on ESPN. I don't know how to rationalize it. I don't know how to believe it. I still don't. And I know it's doable for anybody.
What is the you've told me this before, but I don't want to mispronounce it. What is the name of this nowhere town? Pierisburg?
Parisburg.
Parisburg. Okay. And that is roughly 24 miles north of Blacksburg, where Virginia Tech is.
Yeah, northwest.
Northwest.
Yes, sir.
Okay. One of the things when I see you on air that I appreciate is it feels like you are able to get your subjects pretty comfortable pretty quickly. Now, again, a lot of times we will see just the finished product. You have a very good producer, obviously, and that's 90% of the ball game. But, you know, I've seen this as well when I see you doing sideline interviews. Do you have a sense as to why you're able to do this, or maybe more importantly, and the better question is, what is your approach to getting people comfortable when you want, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes of their time?
Pretty simple. I study very hard. And then when I go in to actually do the interview, I ask them open-ended questions that let them tell me their story. I'm talking about like very broad questions. I just had this opportunity. I'll tell you a story. In the Marty Smith's America that's going to air here in a couple of days, it might be the most impactful interview I've done personally, and it certainly is in some time. I interviewed Elena Deladon, the tremendous ladies basketball player, about her familial dynamic. And Elena's older sister, Lizzie, is deaf and blind. She has autism and cerebral palsy. And she is the superstar of the family. Her brother played major college football at Duke. She is arguably the best women's basketball player on the planet, won a gold medal. And then there's Lizzie. So let's discuss that whole familial dynamic. And as I was chatting with her about this situation, I recalled that I had read about why she came home from the University of Connecticut. You know, she's going to go play for Geno Auriemma, and she's going to win four national championships, and she's going to dominate the competition on ESPN every other night. And she makes the decision very quickly to leave UConn and come home to Delaware. Why? Well, it was Lizzie, and as she's discussing this passion and this love that she has for her sister, she breaks down crying. And in the aftermath of the interview, when all the cameras are gone and we're sitting around cutting up and continuing to discuss my family and her family, she's getting married here in 2 days. And she said, I want to tell you something. I do a lot of interviews, and I don't often feel like the person I'm talking to gives a damn that they care about me. But you do. I can tell you care about me. And I was taken aback by that. And I looked over at John. You talked about great producers. My producer, Jonathan Wiley, is the best of the best of the best. And I looked over at him, and I kind of winked at him. Because our goal, Richard, our goal is to inject joy into people's lives by opening these stars that we meet and these stars that we appreciate their athletic talent, open them up as human beings to the world. And do so in an overwhelmingly positive, introspective way. And when she said that to me, I looked over at Jonathan, and he looked at me, and an unspoken appreciation for one another was exchanged. And that matters to me, man. I mean, it matters deeply to me. And I don't care if I'm talking to Elena, or I'm talking to Nick Saban, or I'm talking to Deshaun Watson, or I'm talking to Jim Harbaugh. The subject doesn't matter to me. That's what I hope to convey. And you know this business. You've forgotten more about this business than I'll ever know, but you know this. Having a platform to do that, especially today, is the rarest of luxuries. And John Skipper down at ESPN, they believed in what we're doing. And I can't believe it. It's fulfilling, very fulfilling.
I want to start now sort of the process from you and NASCAR to where you are now as sort of a long-form interviewer as well as college football. But let's start with this. You become ESPN's lead NASCAR reporter for both SportsCenter and the network's NASCAR coverage. That assignment lasts roughly from like 2006-07 to 2014. NBC yep. Sports replaces ESPN as a NASCAR television rights holder. So now basically, you are a single sports specialist, and that is what you are mostly known at ESPN, and NASCAR is all of a sudden gone. What at that point of your professional career, what are you thinking about when they lost the contract? What are you talking with your agent? And did you think that, oh man, like either I got to leave ESPN or I got to figure something out because basically what I've been known for is going to be reduced at this company now, you know, by 80, 90, 70%.
Well, I don't want to get all preachy, but I'll say this. Like, I'm a man of faith, right? So I kind of do look at everything through that lens. And so I just said, all right, man, whatever your plan is, I'm game. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I didn't have an old shit moment. Because I had a bunch of old shit moments. Like, man, wow. Okay, I love working for ESPN. It's a dream, but I'm a NASCAR guy, so what do I do? And so Matt Kramer, my agent, and I did have a lot of those conversations, and I had a lot of conversations with John Wildhack, who is now the AD at Syracuse and was formerly the kind of second in charge of ESPN. And I didn't know how it was going to unfold. But I'll kind of give you the quickest version. I had I had kind of gotten the idea that they were interested in me and that John Wildhack believed I could excel in other sports, namely college football, because I do have this genuine passion. And it is so applicable to the passion of college football. I love to immerse myself in cultures. And I hope that that is conveyed, whether I'm going to China with Ronaldo or I'm putting on full pads at Alabama and scaring the hell out of the compliance guys because I'm running the 50 in full pads. But I love that immersion. And John and those guys felt like, hey, I think this is applicable. I think he can do this. And so I had been on the road, November 2014, let's go back there. I had been on the road about 100 of 130 days during the ESPN portion of the broadcast year for NASCAR. And that is 20 straight weeks of NASCAR, 5 days a week, roughly. It's a Thursday to Monday prospect when you cover NASCAR racing full time. So I had been in Miami, Florida for the season finale. I get home on a Monday morning, and I think it was November 17th. I can't recall, but that date stands out to me. It was somewhere around in that area. And I walked in the door, and my amazing, beautiful, understanding for reasons I don't know, wife Lainey said to me, I need you home. I'm cooked. We have three young children. At that time, like I have 12, 8, and 5 now. At that time, they were 3 years younger. All right. So she's just smoked. She's been a single parent basically for 4 or 5 months. And I said, don't worry. They're not going to call me until January. I'm going to be mostly home. I might do some one-off things, but I'll be home most of the time. Richard, I shit you not. We put our children in the car for Lainey to take them to school. I sit down on my couch with my phone. I pour myself a cup of coffee and I take that deep breath, that like cleansing breath that, okay, man, we made it through another season. So I'm just emotionally and mentally smoked. And I open up my email and I got an email from Lee Fitting. And Lee runs college sports for ESPN. Lee is one of those guys that built Game Day into this titan. And it said, hey, brother, I love what you've done in NASCAR. I love how passionate you are about the way you report. I think you need to be in college football. Start studying because you're going to be one of my four reporters that's going to be integrated and immersed with a team for the inaugural college football playoff. And Richard, I took my phone and I held it out from my, like, I put it as far as my arm could extend away from my face. And I just went, holy shit. Because I can't, it's beyond comprehension to your point a moment ago that a sports-centric person, especially in NASCAR, which is kind of on this island all by itself, not stick and ball, more niche, that a guy would write that sentence. And I called Lainey right then and I said, I don't know how to say this to you. And she said, where are you going? And I said, I need you to trust me on something. I have been asked to be among the members of the inaugural college football playoff team reports. And that means I'm going to be gone a little bit longer, but this is going to change our lives. And I need you to trust me on this. I know it's hard, and I know it's so much harder on you than it is on me, but it's going to change our lives. Because the one thing in sport that I was more passionate about than NASCAR was college football. Because of my dad. I grew up in Blacksburg, Virginia, man. The Virginia Tech Hokies are our pro team. And I couldn't believe it. And sure enough, Cardale Jones starts writing a book, and I got to ride that horse with those guys all the way to that national championship.
Right.
Unbelievable, right? I mean, back to those grains of sand, man. It doesn't happen. And I was blessed enough that Lee and John Wildhack and those folks, Mike McQuaid and everybody involved in that believed and gave me that chance. And another thing that needs to be said here is Urban Meyer. They dropped me in Columbus, Ohio. I have no contacts. I know no one. I've never met anyone. I couldn't pick Cardale Jones, Ezekiel Elliott, Joey Bosa, Michael Thomas, the stars of that team out of a lineup. I didn't even know what they looked like, man. And every one of them gave me time, insight, and respect I hadn't earned and didn't deserve. And I'm forever indebted to them for that.
That's a great story. And that, of course, leads to you cover college football, and the executives at ESPN are like, all right, you know what? This guy can embed with a group and produce some interesting stuff. That then, of course, leads to this opportunity where you and Jonathan Wiley travel to Iceland following Iceland's national team's amazing run in the 2016 Euros. And you should tell this story because, Marty, I don't think I'm overstating this. That the work you do in Iceland is the direct line to this current show that you're fronting, correct? Once some executives saw that you could do that kind of reporting from a faraway place, clearly that gave them the confidence to give you a shot of doing your own solo project.
Unequivocally, yes. I was in Seattle, Washington, hosting an event. My phone rang. It was Tim McHugh. Tim runs the Bureau Division of ESPN, for which I work. And Tim said, I got a weird one for you, but I think you're going to crush it. You're going to get on a plane and you're going to fly to Iceland. And I said, what in the Sam hell for? And he said, they have qualified for Euros. And I said, well, explain to me, what does that mean? And basically, I kind of liken it to my alma mater, Radford University, qualifying for the Final Four. You know, like it's this massive thing. And I was like, awesome, man, let's ride. And it's just another one of those opportunities that, like, that gets my, like, that's the juice. In my soul, that's the juice. We're going to let you go do this. And we're going to let you go do whatever you do. And Richard, we got on an airplane. Jonathan and myself got on an airplane. And look, man, it was him and it was me. That's it. Two of us. And we got on an airplane. We flew to Boston. We changed planes. We got on an Icelandic air plane to Reykjavik. And I am not lying to you. God is my witness. We had no plan. We got on that plane with no plan. And Jonathan, who is brilliant at putting together great content opportunities that he is putting on a tee for me to execute. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So, dude, he got us in one day. He got us the president of the nation. He got us the most famous band in the nation, which is called Of Monsters and Men. And he got us one of the most famous athletes in the nation. His name is Gunnar Nelson. He's an MMA star, and he happens to be Conor McGregor's boy, like best buddy. Right. Training partner, I think. They work together a lot. So we had this idea. We're going to go to Reykjavik, and we're going to take advantage of this phenomenon that is this Viking chant that really became a phenomenon globally. And so we're going to go get these dignitaries in the country to show us how to do the Viking chant. That was it. Like, that was our idea. And it turned into one of the people still ask me about it. But another thing that we like to do is, Jonathan and myself, we like to show off the places that we are. We like to do what we call senses of place, these essays that really immerse you in the place. And then we started doing live shots too. And they were very resonant. I mean, here's a story about that guy, Gunnar Nelson. We call him on his cell phone. We get his dad somehow. I don't even remember how we got his dad. We get his dad on the horn. He's like, hey, oh yeah, here's his number. So I call this dude and he's like, yeah, man, come on out. Come on out to my compound. It's 45 minutes out of Reykjavik. You'll find it. Just come on out. We're on like dirt roads. I don't know where we're driving, but it happens to be the most beautiful place I've ever seen, so we're cool with it. And we drive all the way out this dirt road, 45, 50 minutes outside of Reykjavik, down this, around this gorgeous lake in the middle of these picturesque, beautiful mountains, and here's this dude in his long johns sitting in a hot tub. Can't make it up. So he gets out of the hot tub, drives off, and goes, so what do y'all some bitches want? And I said, really, to be honest with you, all I want you to do is choke me out, man. He goes, excuse me? I said, yeah, I want you to, like, perform like a... We're going to do the Viking chant, and then I want you to like drop me and choke me out like you would somebody in the ring. And he goes, shit, all right. So he like leg sweeps me and starts to put the tiniest amount of pressure on me, and I tap out. I'm like, oh my God, stop. Oh my God, stop. So it was just an amazing experience. But that whole tangent is, yes, our work there really resonated, not just to the consumer, but to our bosses. And that was kind of the thing that lit the Marty Smith's America wick. And then we went to Rome with Harbaugh and the boys, and that really did light the fire of Marty Smith's America.
This is a total tangent, but like people who've been to Iceland have told me that that you want, if you're going to eat something there, you want to eat fish, or am I incorrect about that?
That's what I eat anyway. I don't eat red meat. I grew up on a beef cattle farm. I don't eat red meat. I will say this to you. The only thing more beautiful than the landscape is the people. It is a wonderful place to be. And like people over there were telling us that in the last several years, their tourism has become their number one industry.
Exactly. Yep.
And it's gone from like 50,000 on average to millions plus. And you can tell because there's hotels going up everywhere, 5-star, beautiful places.
Right.
It's an awesome place to visit.
Yeah, and great music scene supposedly too, so that none of this surprises me.
And I was over there with Wright Thompson, which is always an experience.
That's right. A couple of Southern guys, Mississippi guy and a Virginia guy.
Brilliant mind. I feel really stupid trying to have a conversation with him.
You can hold your own, Marty. Come on. All right. I want to ask you a couple things before I get to some questions from people. When I put out there on Twitter that you were going to be on, I got some really interesting questions. But one of the things that obviously is very, very tricky to navigate at ESPN, Marty, if you're a front-facing person, and again, you're not as front-facing as Scott Van Pelt or Reese Davis, but you're on camera. People know who you are, and you have your own show. As you know, 2016 and 2017, it is very tricky terrain if you're on social media, and particularly tricky terrain if you're on social media talking about social issues, politics, etc. Do you have any kind of philosophy that you follow when it comes to what you want to say or what you don't want to say on your own personal social media feeds?
I try very hard to keep it to my personal passions and to my work, and at times to my family. I try not to put my family out there very often because they didn't ask for this life. I did. But I am a very engaged and passionate dad and husband. So sometimes I do that. I don't discuss politics. Not my thing. I have my opinions. I keep them myself. And, outside of that, there you go. Like, that's my social media policy.
Right.
I have learned in the past couple of years, I'm impulsive by nature. It's the way I'm made. I'm a pretty intense cat. And so if something riles me up or if something is frustrating, I turn it off. I turn it off and I walk away from it and I take deep breaths and I try to really define my own personal emotions. I try to look inside myself about, why do you feel that way? Are you mad about that because it's your own insecurity? Are you mad about that because you have that much conviction about what is said? What is it? And if I could process it that way, then typically my impulse reaction was unnecessary. Does that make sense?
It does. Without obviously giving away your politics, how do you feel about those who posit that ESPN fundamentally is more left-leaning, progressive, liberal than not? And I'm not saying I agree with that, because I think if you watch ESPN 24 hours a day, you will, interestingly enough, see very little politics on air. You might see a lot of politics on social media, but that's different. But I am curious because... it's a question that I ask a lot of the ESPN people I have on, and I get a lot of different answers, perhaps because they have different POVs as to how they see it. So without going into whatever your politics are, I am interested in how you feel about those who would suggest that, both in the media and outside the media.
I think each person is individual. I think each person's, I hate to use the word brands, Richard, but I think, is it fair that we all kind of have them, I guess? We all sort of have our own images and all of those things and our own convictions about things. And I like to be liked, and that's probably a flaw, and that's why I just don't, it's just not my thing. I don't put it out there. Now, of course, I read voraciously. I see what people say about our network, but my job is telling people stories, and my job is trying to open people up to tell their own stories and be vulnerable, right? And reduce the veneer that all of us tend to put up. So I don't give a shit what somebody may say about quote ESPN's politics. I go try to do what I'm doing. And that may, that is the honest to God, the way that I operate. I go, like, each subject or each assignment, I am a single-minded approach. I want to do the best job introducing or introducing that subject or growing awareness of that subject.
Marty, one of the Jamie Little and Shannon Spake were podcast guests. They did it together, and I'm fascinated by people who report in NASCAR because it's such an interesting beat, and I don't think reporters who have covered it get enough credit, both in broadcast as well as in print, for how hard it is to navigate 40 teams. Mm-hmm. And to try to make all those contacts, even if, like, the sport, let's say, isn't as covered, I don't know how to phrase this, but, like, even if it's not, there's, like, not as many, quote-unquote, negative stories about NASCAR the way there might be on a given NFL week, to actually cover the sport the way Shannon did, Jamie did, you did, is hard, just given the sheer number of different teams, different personalities, and sort of juggling acts that you have to do. So that's my sort of preamble or intro into, were there things that you learned about, how would you say your experience in reporting NASCAR ended up helping you both in college football and on this current, like, interview show you're doing?
It was a very different type of job than I have now. And anyone who's listening to this that is a beat reporter will relate to this. In my current role, I can go in and I can ask really broad stroke questions that, you know, is tell me about your program or why does this work? Or, you know, I'm in this next Marty Smith America, I went fishing with Paul George from the Oklahoma City Thunder because he's infatuated with fishing. It's his bond with his dad.
Nice.
He said to me that he found himself, like, he found his joy. He found his passion about life on the water with his dad. Okay, why? Right? So it's these really broad stroke things. I don't have to nail down about whether the slot receiver is going to play on Sunday or not. They're very different jobs. And when I was covering NASCAR, that was really it. It was the day-to-day, race-to-race, finite detail. And so I did really get a great body of understanding about that type of reporting. And you're right. The people the folks that cover NASCAR, it is not easy. And it's such a grind. I mean, the season is very long. As I said earlier, it's a 5-day a week prospect, and it just, you know, you're in Martinsville, Virginia, and then you're in nowhere, you know, you're in Loudoun, New Hampshire, and you're in, you know, on and on, and it's just not easy. But it definitely prepared me for this, because when you're interviewing the same people every single day, basically, you have to learn how to be creative, and you have to really be thoughtful about how you craft questions to get something new and interesting. And I learned all of that on the fly. So I would say that's probably how it prepared me best, because I feel like I have a pretty decent grasp of what's a good question. I still find myself at times being pissed at myself because there was something there to follow up on and garner more depth, and I missed it. And those things make me I try to learn from that, but I'm getting better. You know, when you're kind of in the same lane as Tom Rinaldi, you better come to work every day, son.
Who did you find to be the most challenging interview in NASCAR, be it a driver, owner?
Tony Stewart.
Crew chief. Why is that?
Because Tony doesn't take any bullshit. For a long time, I would have answered Dale Jr. Because Dale is extremely intelligent. I mean, really, really intelligent, well-read. And he expects you to come prepared. And if he got any inkling that you did not come prepared, he would not suffer it. Hmm. There's been this great evolution of Dale as a person, and he is, he's a wonderful human being. And I want, you know, it's been interesting to see how much more he is willing to give now at this stage in his life. He's the best interview in sports, period. Okay. It's not even close.
That's interesting.
And I have, again, at this point in my career, I really have had the great opportunity to interview a lot of different people, stars and different sports and whatnot. He's the best interview in sport. He is very considerate of what is being asked. He is thoughtful of how he is answering and that his answer is genuine. And he's awesome. But he wasn't that easy earlier on. Hmm. And Tony, kind of the same way, he demands that you're prepared. And if he thinks a question is stupid, he's just going to tell you, hey, that's really stupid. And, there's a lot of guys. Kevin Harvick is a really good interview when you're prepared, and he'll tell you when you're not. I don't know. That's probably another way that it really prepared me for now is going through those trials and with those guys and knowing when I asked them a question sometimes that they weren't very impressed by that.
All right, let's finish up with a couple questions from readers. First off, I was asked for your top five atmospheres in college football.
Wow.
And maybe we'll take a why on that.
Okay. The greatest atmosphere I've ever been a part of was LSU, Death Valley and Baton Rouge on Saturday night. Now, granted, they were playing Alabama and it was a night kickoff and everybody was lubed up real good. but I'm gonna tell you, man, like at the end of the third quarter, there's a song by Garth Brooks called Calling Baton Rouge. And they played that song on a loudspeaker, and there was 100,000 people singing their ass off, and the whole joint was swaying. I was floored. It was awesome. I went to Texas A&M this year. A&M is elite. They never stop cheering. They have all of those yells and all of those choreographed chants that they do, and they are incessant with them. I was very impressed with A&M. I love Clemson, South Carolina. I love Blacksburg, Virginia. I went to my first whiteout in college or in a state college, Pennsylvania, at Penn State a couple weeks ago when they hosted Michigan. I was very impressed with that. That's hard. I mean, I would say right now that's them. I just had Ohio State and Penn State this past weekend, and it got wild, you know, because of the way that Ohio State came back. But God, man, college football is beautiful.
Yeah,
God bless you.
That's a great list, and I've only been to one SEC game in my life, and it was a night game at LSU for Alabama.
Insane, right?
Incredible. I've never seen, you know, I'm a northerner, and from New York. So that world, while I think it's amazing to watch on TV, it was impossible for me to really get a sense of it until I did this story on Vern Lundquist last year in the SEC. And so SI let me pick the game I wanted. I talked to a lot of people. They said, if you're going to ever like go to an SEC game, try to go to Death Valley at night. And just being there the weekend, hanging out with LSU people and their purple tailgating, walking on the field beforehand, like I'm never going to be as well versed as others in college football, but it game changed sort of how let's put it this way. I now can understand people a lot better who talk about the sport the way like my friends grew up talking about basketball or baseball. Like I finally right. got it, and I would have never gotten it if I didn't spend that weekend in Baton Rouge.
So was it last year? Last season?
It was last year. Yeah, that night.
I was there. Man, hey. That was off the chain.
Incredible. Never heard anything.
That's the juice. If that doesn't get you right, if that does not define for you why these teams are the identities of their town,
yep.
Nothing will.
I've never heard anything louder at a stadium, and I've seen World Soccer in Barcelona and Spain and other places. I've been to seven Olympics. I've never heard anything that loud. It was the most incredible thing, or at least the most incredible sound I had heard. And like you, they let us, you know, because CBS, of course, has like the pull. We had a police escort drive the CBS truck to the stadium. And Marty, I'm sure you see this every weekend. Just the waves of people who like are watching these players, 18 to 22, come into the campus.
Yep.
I mean, it's like rock stars, basically. I've never, it was unbelievable. It was just
and that's
crazy.
Why, like, if you... Richard, if you go talk to young men who are in the NFL, who played at Bama, who played at LSU, who played at Clemson, who played at Georgia, they will tell you that the NFL is pretty dull by comparison.
Right.
Because that high that you get on those Saturday nights is forever. I mean, it is a forever thing. It's awesome.
Another question I got in, if your show continues, who are some of the subjects that you would really, really like to get? You obviously, Paul George and Elena Deladon, we're talking, A-level people. I know on your last show, I think you did Maverick Carter was part of it. So, you know, somebody in LeBron's orbit is really interesting. But do you have a couple of wish listers who, if the show continues, you really want to get?
Michael Jordan?
Yeah.
Above all. As childhood, I'm a 40-year-old man. As childhood heroes go, anybody my age adored MJ. I mean, he just made us all dream and believe that we could do amazing things. And he lives 10 minutes away from me. Come on, Mike. I'll tell you one person that I really want to interview is George W. Bush. And if I had my way, I would really rather interview. I think it'd be so cool to interview Obama and Bush and Clinton together. Now, I know that's like a pipe dream,
right?
But they're all sports guys.
George W., I think you could get. That doesn't strike me as an impossibility. The three guys together might be hard. But George W., I feel like that's a possibility.
When you look at indelible moments in sport over the past 50 years, him throwing that seed during that first pitch after 9/11.
Yep.
I was going to get an interview with him. I knew it. And then I come to find out there was a 30 for 30, I think a short 30 for 30 short done on that
right.
pitch. It's brilliant, by the way. I don't remember who directed it, but it's brilliant. But I just want to sit down with him and talk sports because, I mean, Clinton is a hardcore college football guy, being an Arkansas guy.
Yep.
Obama loves college hoops. It'd be so fun. It'd be so fun.
Yep, Clinton, if I remember my SI history, on the cover in 1994 with a basketball high on the hogs, and that's when Arkansas, I think, had...
Scotty Thurman, Corliss Williamson.
That's right, Corliss Williamson.
40 minutes ahead, yeah, Richardson.
Nolan Richardson, yeah, man. Yeah, Nolan was pretty tight with the Clinton clan at the time. You interviewed Cam Newton for your show, and I wondered if you had some thoughts on... it's been a really interesting... I thought you got some really interesting stuff out of Cam.
Thank you.
And it's been an interesting fall for him given his relationship with the media, given your that's your part of the world, you live there, and you interviewed Cam, I wanted to just sort of give you the floor in terms of what do you think is going on with Cam, and in particular, what do you think is going on with Cam and his relationship with the Charlotte media?
I don't know, because I'm not there every day. Again, it's one of those scenarios where I got invited to attend his event. He gave me an entire day, and our goal was to try to get into his mind about his convictions about being the face of a community and all of those types of things. And, you know, what people say about him that's not true and all of that kind of stuff. I'm not in the day to day. I don't know about his relationship with the Charlotte media. So I cannot answer that in an educated way.
Fair enough. All right, the final sort of place I want to go with you on is as you head forward at ESPN, you have your interview show, Marty Smith's America. You obviously now are part of the college football rotation, which is obviously a great situation to be in. As you head forward, Marty, are these the two tracks that you want to do at ESPN where, you know, you get to do the live experience where you're on the sideline doing major college football? And you obviously have this interview show where you could really scratch your Jones about doing long-form interviews and stuff. I mean, having interviewed a lot of people in your business and a lot of people at ESPN, let's forget about money or anything else. You have a great job, in my opinion, right now, in that you get to experience live sports, which at the highest levels of college football are awesome. And then you have this interview show, which most people at ESPN do not get, where you and Jonathan can basically cherry-pick if they agree to do these sit-downs with really interesting people. So it strikes me that you have a great situation now. I wonder how you look at it in terms of how you think about it heading forward.
I have the best job in the world. Not lip service, not hyperbole, not BS. I have the best job in the world. And I don't take it for granted. I consider it every single day. I ask myself every single day, are you honoring this opportunity properly? And I believe at this point we are. I think we're doing a pretty good job. And I will say that I said this to John Skipper very recently and Connor Schell very recently, Rob King. ESPN is really the last frontier of networks that are fully committed to great storytelling. Period. Because I don't see, where else do you see it?
If you're asking me that question, the nobody in sports right now invests more capital dollars, emotional investment in doing long form on air sports journalism than ESPN. It's not close.
Exactly. So that's why I like to tell stories about people, and I know that it resonates. I know it does. Whether I'm going to the gym, the grocery store, the airport, whatever, people are approaching with questions about whomever it is that we're interviewing. And so I know it's working. I know it matters. I know it has depth. I know it has resonance. And I know that ESPN is committed to that. And so I am just so honored to have it. And I know, I'm sure there were a lot of people when they announced Marty Smith's America that went, why? Like, why him? Why is he getting that? Why does he deserve that? I don't know the answer to that. But I'm taking it very seriously, and I'm very appreciative of it. And I hope that the work is answering that question somewhat.
Marty Smith is a college football reporter for ESPN. You have also known his work, of course, on NASCAR going back 10-plus or having his NASCAR work for more than 10 years with the network. Right now, he is the host of Marty Smith's America, which is a monthly television program where Marty goes pretty in-depth with interesting people. This month's episode is Paul George of the Thunder and Elena Deladon of the WNBA's Washington Mystics, and obviously gold medalist and a really interesting person. That show is on Friday. This podcast will come out on Thursday. So Friday, 7 p.m. on ESPN2. Marty, when I've talked to you, like you, I'm not a bullshitter. I really admire and like what you're doing. And again, this is a kid from, you know, who has lived in the Upper West Side of New York. I'm very far away from Virginia. And so, but I like seeing you on air. I relate to what you're doing, I think, because I sense that it's legit and the passion and the enthusiasm that you show for your work registers with me. So I'm glad I got a chance to talk to you. But beyond that, I hope you keep doing what you're doing. I really enjoy it.
Well, that means a lot to me, man. You know, you get the opportunity to interview and spend time with the best of the best. And so I appreciate you giving me some time and being interested in my story. And I am going to send you a damn thank you letter.
Yeah, I won't take it, but that's nice of you to offer. I know you, Tom Rinaldi and you are very famous for sending handwritten notes to people that you've interacted with, which I certainly respect as a human being, but yeah, it just makes me uncomfortable to get any correspondence from ESPN, Marty. It's not just you; it's your PR department. It's everything else.
So. Those letters matter, man.
No, I'm telling you. I may take this one. You've worn me down. you've beaten me down. I'll take it. Well, Marty, we appreciate it, and we wish you the best of luck with Marty Smith's America. Thanks so much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
I appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Marty Smith. No bullshit. Like I said, I find that guy really interesting, and I appreciate his interviews. And check out his show. That's one I'm an endorsement on. So I appreciate his time. We now bring in an old friend of the podcast. That would be John Oran of the Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal. He has been on this podcast maybe 8 or 9 times. John, welcome back to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
8 or 9 times, but it's been a while since I've been on. This is good.
You were pushed off for Chad Finn and others, but you're now back. You're my A guy now again. So you're number one. All right, so we're going to do 20-25 minutes on a singular story that you wrote, John. The headline of the story, October 30th, how ESPN went from confident to queasy on Barstool Sports. This, to me, is far and away the most... I did a piece myself, and I talked to Erica Nardini on the record. She's the CEO of Barstool Sports. But this is far and away, John, I think, the most sourcing inside ESPN in terms of what went down from their end on why this was, you know, why the dissolution of the relationship and why eventually John Skipper pulled the Barstool Van Talk show 1 week after it came on. So here's where I want to start, John. And again, a lot of Sports Business Daily stuff is behind a paywall, but this is free. So you can basically go online and find it. Just Google John's name and Barstool Sports. It'll come right up. I highly recommend the piece. All right. So first off, John, here's where I want to start. Your piece starts off with you're telling this sort of anecdote about in the days before ESPN signs this contract with Barstool, Sam Ponder's agent, a guy named Nick Kahn, who both of us have spoken to on the record many, many times. We both know, very, very powerful, smart agent at CAA, has 50, 60 ESPNers or whatever the crazy number is. He sends an email to ESPN president John Skipper and Connor Schell, the new executive vice president of content, about Barstool Sports. According to you, in that email, screenshots from the Barstool blog where Dave Portnoy, the head of Barstool, really sort of calls out Sam Ponder, talking about being, to quote you, a Bible-thumping freak, a chick that has a job where the number one requirement is you make men hard. I mean, it's misogynist. There's no way around that. It's sexist. This is independent of whatever Sam Ponder has tweeted about anybody else in the past or present. It's sort of, if you just take that blog on face, it is what it is. So let's start here, John. What's interesting to me is that based on your reporting, ESPN officials know full well at least what the worst of Barstool is in relation to Barstool saying things about their employees, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And did you have a second question, or do you want me to just...
I want you to expand on that, and I will go from there.
Okay, so... And the crux of the problem here is that ESPN had little interest in doing a deal with Barstool. They they found Barstool to be, they knew that they would have sort of an uprising internally, and they would have a hard time. I mean, they're a Disney-owned company. They would have a hard time given a lot of what Barstool has posted and done in the past. What they did like is they liked Big Cat and PFT, or Pro Football Commenter. And they thought that they could take, you know, pardon my take, and build a brand off that, which would be almost separate from Barstool. And so, you know, that outlines sort of the crux of the problem there. And you know, Nick Khan's email essentially was saying, like, listen, I know you guys know, and of course they did know all this. It didn't come as a surprise. I know you know there's this problem. It would be really good if you sort of talk to my client through it, because she's having problems with it.
Okay, so I want to get to the conversation they had with Sam Ponder. What obviously, and again, I've written this, is sort of a little tricky, not tricky, it's a little hard to swallow, of course, is that, you know, you can't get a little bit pregnant. You're either in with Barstool or you're not in with Barstool. And while there's no doubt that the part of my take guys have their own sort of independent silo, and they're certainly very talented, and, you know, 25-plus ESPNers have been on that show. The fact is, when ESPNers appear on that show, they're appearing on Barstool Sports. They're helping the Barstool Sports brand. So while, you know, I feel like ESPN obviously is sort of trying to thread this fine line, John, there really, in the end, is no line. If you sort of just step on, you know, stop on it, it's you are either in business with Barstool Sports or not. So we get to Nick Khan sending this stuff, as you reported, to John Skipper and Connor Schell. And John Skipper and Connor Schell bring in Burke Magnus. He's an executive vice president of programming and scheduling into the loop. Burke Magnus is absolutely, by far and away, the biggest internal advocate for doing this Barstool deal. He's been talking to Erica Nardini at Barstool. He's a huge supporter of the Pardon My Take podcast. But ESPN has this problem, because one of their talents, obviously, is not happy about Barstool's founder crushing her in print. So Sam Ponder goes in to talk to, based on your reporting, Stephanie Drewley. That's a senior vice president of events and studio production. Used to run the Longhorn Network, and I believe knows Sam Ponder from there, someone who Ponder knows for a long, long time. And so they have this meeting, very senior executive with Sam Ponder. And then based on your reporting, Ponder leaves the meeting more confused than angry. Can you give us some more insight into that? What went down in that meeting, and why is the resolution the talent walks out more confused than angry?
Well, more confused than angry, because I think that Sam Ponder essentially thought that by bringing this to light and bringing what they said to light, certainly given the current environment where you have Roger Ailes and you have Bill O'Reilly and, you know, and everything, you know, ESPN is going to want to steer clear of this and not want to touch Barstool or Dave Portnoy with a 50-foot pole. And so she was pretty confident that would happen. She also knows that, you know, the email was sent to, you know, Connor and Skipper, and it was Connor, Skipper, and Magnus. And all of a sudden she's having a conversation with, you know, Stephanie Drewley, who she's known for a long time.
Right.
But you know, she's not having it with any of those sort of people that are in charge.
Yeah.
So and basically she was told no. So she was told, you know, that ESPN was going to move forward with this, and it made a lot of sense to move forward. So, you know, I don't think she was furious at being told no. I just think she was just like, it wasn't explained fully about like why it made sense to ignore all this stuff on one end and move forward on this other end.
Do you have any kind of time frame element as to when that meeting with Sam Ponder and Stephanie Drewley took place in relation to whenever the first Barstool show aired?
That meeting with happened roughly like several days to a week before Ponder's tweets that she put out.
All right, so let's get to that. Sam Ponder welcomes Barstool to ESPN by repurposing this blog post about her, and basically sort of clearly sends a message saying that this is unacceptable to me. Here's what these guys wrote about me at the time. Again, just so the Barstool people know, I know that Sam Ponder has some questionable tweets I understand that. It's a larger part of the context of the story. For this purpose now, I want to focus on what John's reporting is inside ESPN. And this is a very important thing, John, because Sam Ponder tweets that, and it immediately is a firestorm, certainly on Twitter. You know, retweeted over 1,000 times, liked however many times it is. You know, it's if you were to, like, obviously measure the engagement of that tweet, you know, it would be in the, you know, high six figures, because that tweet prompts people to write about Sam Ponder's tweet. It puts re-examination on the ESPN Barstool relationship, and this is where I want to get to your reporting again. It clearly galvanizes a group of people within ESPN who are going to now voice displeasure internally to John Skipper, sending John Skipper emails, calling John Skipper. Can you give some kind of indication, based on your reporting, what John Skipper, Connor Schell, and or Burke Magnus were dealing with after that Sam Ponder tweet goes viral?
Yeah, they were dealing with a crisis at that point, because none of them knew that the tweets were coming. You know, the tweets weren't, obviously they weren't approved, but there was no sort of heads up given. And so, you know, according to, like, Skipper and Schell and Magnus, they had thought, like, okay, we listened to the complaint, we addressed the complaint, and we made a decision to move forward, and everything sort of happened in the background. You know, they didn't have any expectation that this was going to go public. And so once Sam Ponder went public with it, and given, you know, what those tweets said and some of the quotes in the tweet, there was it wasn't a huge group at ESPN, but it was a small, passionate, and powerful group that ended up really appealing to Skipper, who, you know, there are a lot of badges that Skipper wears, but one of the ones that he wears most proudly is the amount of diversity that he has at ESPN, from the employee ranks to the on-air ranks, and sort of seeing these tweets, seeing how it's affecting a lot of women that work at ESPN. You know, he decided to sort of reopen it and take another look at it.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was going to say, from your reporting, is there any kind of split between John Skipper, Connor Schell, and Burke Magnus, where maybe Skipper, now with being inundated by this small but influential group, is starting to think, you know what, maybe this relationship isn't worth it, where Connor Schell and certainly Burke Magnus are like, listen, this is a really good deal for us. It's going to get us 18 to 34-year-olds, and we could contain whatever we perceive to be the worst parts of Barstool versus our relationship with these two guys, who we think are the best parts of Barstool and don't carry the same kind of baggage that maybe others at Barstool, or specifically Dave Portnoy, does.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate this to where it was like, you know, this huge rift. I think that there was certainly a difference of opinion.
Okay.
And so, you know, Magnus and Schell, they understood the concept of it. They liked the idea of moving forward with it. They liked the idea of bringing in people that don't necessarily watch television that would watch that, and they liked being associated with, you know, Big Cat and PFT. So they wanted to move forward with it. And John Skipper, and I think you already reported this as well, I think they described it as a unilateral decision. You know, and he ultimately decided, like, I just don't want to do this. I do know that there was a group of people that was trying to push him to say, like, okay, we'll cancel it, but let's run it for like five or six shows and then sort of more quietly, you know, get rid of it. But, you know, Skipper was like, look, we're just going to have to do it, you know, sooner rather than later.
John, based on your reporting, and I think this is a fair question and would be asked by certainly women outside of ESPN, is there any woman who is part of this decision-making process to address sexism in previous pieces from Barstool, and how Sam Ponder feels as a high-profile woman working in the business? Because it's very clear, obviously, on the Magnus and Connor Schell side, and they're correct about this. They understand the value of getting Barstool's incredible loyal audience to head to ESPN, 18 to 34-year-old men. ESPN, let's face it, is not the coolest brand right now, given multitudes and multitude reasons. But from your reporting, is there, as far as you know, is there a senior woman in the room who is addressing any of the sexism stuff?
Well, I think that would be, you know, Stephanie Drewley's role.
Okay.
To be doing that. But I you know, there is a lack of female representation among those decision makers up at the top there. It's you know, Skipper's kitchen cabinet right now is, you know, all men, all white men, and, you know, they're in their 40s, early 50s.
Okay, here's something that's really interesting to me, and this is one of the things I really was looking forward to talking to you about. John, you know, like you, I reported this piece. People can read. John and I have sort of there's a lot of similar reporting that we did, but we sort of approach it from different ways. ESPN executives, John, continue to decline me. Maybe they don't decline you because they love you, but they're declining me through the PR department. So we have not seen ESPN executives on the record discussing this. This relates to my question about this. You write, and I open quote here, Skipper knew what he was getting into before he signed off on the deal, but he was caught off guard by the fury associated with it. Over the weekend, he continued having conversations with upset ESPNers, both executives and on-air talent. He continued to click through some of Barstool's content. His unease grew. It's good graph there. But here's my question, John. How can John Skipper know what he's getting into before signing off on the deal, if on the weekend he's starting to now go through Barstool's content and is getting queasy about it? What, like, was the due diligence not there from his lieutenants, or did they just roll the dice and think, all right, we're going to thread this line that we're in business with Part of My Take, but whatever happened with Barstool in the past, we'll live with it. Erica Nardini is a bright CEO. We like her. We're having a good relationship now in 2017. Do you know what I'm saying, John? There's like a disconnect there to me in that they signed off on this deal, yet over the weekend, you know, it's like X-Files. They're going back in deep into the Barstool archives finding this stuff. Like, how did you not know what you were signing up for, I guess is my question.
Well, they signed up for the deal. They actually ran a show for the deal. The first show came after one of Ponder's tweets, and they reconvened and said, are we ready? Are we sure we're going to do this? They did the show. The show got okay ratings, you know, and it didn't break the bank, but it did well, you know, it did well enough. As I said in the story, that, you know, Burke Magnus tweeted out some of the numbers for it, and then it was just really the fury of people that, you know, that reached out to Skipper. I think it was a level of people. I think it was people that Skipper really trusted, and it hit a I don't want to say political, because it doesn't really get political, but it hits something that Skipper holds dear. You know, I mean, the whole idea of diversity and the whole idea of a workforce that respects everybody else, and so kind of, you know, that once people were made aware of what happened to Sam Ponder, and once people were made aware that this deal actually happened, you know, that's when they really started going after Skipper. So it was that sort of lobbying campaign that really was effective, in my opinion.
Here's something that was really, really interesting to me that you wrote. You write, Skipper believed that Barstool would do something in the next few days, weeks, or months that would put ESPN in a bad light. He had a sense that something eventually would happen that would cause him to cancel the show. He may as well do it sooner rather than later. John, I would contend, just from looking at this agnostically in terms of observing the news cycle, I think the news cycle was starting to slow down. And in my opinion, whether you think they should have or not, had they stayed the course and aired the second show with Dan Patrick, etc., I think the news cycle dials down even more. And I think as me and you taped this on November 1st, if they did not cut bait, I think there would have been, from those who really are upset with this deal, they would have been like, we don't like it, but we're just going to live with it. And I think from the Barstool side, they would have done their best to not done anything to embarrass the relationship between them and ESPN. I believe if Skipper had held out, I think he would have been in an okay place in terms of not having Barstool put them in a bad light. Am I being too optimistic with my read? How do you read it?
I think that you're reading something differently than what Skipper was reading, because I would agree with you that this ESPN deal would have died down. But I think that, you know, there are different posts and videos that are made every day that people are now saying, like, oh gosh, look what Barstool did now. And then within those posts, there's going to be like, you know, Barstool, which has a show on ESPN. ESPN would all of a sudden been dragged in to a lot more of Barstool's raunchy posts. And he was like, he just saw that happening and he didn't want any part of it. So it wasn't necessarily about the press about the ESPN deal. It was more just about getting more associated so publicly with the Barstool brand.
That's interesting. And I as a lead executive in John Skipper's position, I do understand that, because once you are in a partnership, if Barstool is doing something on their site, by association, you are tagged with that. Now, John, here's my counter to that, I guess. You know, there have been 20-plus ESPNers, 30 ESPNers who have been on Barstool's show, Rachel Nichols and Scott Van Pelt, repeatedly. And I don't believe, like, they've been tagged in a certain way by their association. I mean, maybe they should, but I don't think they've been tagged by that association in the way that, you know, to sort of use your thinking, ESPN may get tagged by what Barstool's doing. You know, it's interesting that the trying to thread the line, again, of we're in business with part of my take and what Barstool does, while we might not like everything, is what Barstool does. Like, that was just a fascinating gambit that they tried to pull off. And I think they went pretty far with that gambit until obviously Skipper shut it down. And it's interesting, John. I wonder if, will we see anything like this attempted again, where ESPN tries to partner with like individual talents at a larger place where maybe they don't like a lot of things in the larger overall?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I found really to be fascinating, Richard, is the Skipper statement that they put out, where he really took pains to talk about PFT and Big Cat, and he. You know, talked about how they did the show that they said they were going to do, and how he thought that they were talented, and you know that was almost like a gambit to them, as if to say, like, you know, as soon as you're free, you know, we still want you, and we think we can get you. So I think that, you know, that they attract. I mean, Burke Magnus has an 18-year-old son. He knows firsthand how 18-year-olds consume Barstool. You know, I have an 18-year-old son. I know firsthand how they do it. And they're not watching ESPN, and they're not watching television. And so I think that, you know, all this isn't unique to ESPN. All TV companies are looking at how they can attract that audience and what talent is out there that can bring in that audience.
Yeah, John, you hit on a couple things there. One, I think Jim Miller made this point too. I've seen a lot of ESPN press statements over the years, as you have. The use of "I" there by John Skipper was significant. You agree? He wanted people to know this was my decision, and sort of I took the lead here. Now, you would obviously expect the president, you know, all the buck, quote unquote, always stops with him or her. But in this case, that was specific to the market. We don't often see the "I"s in ESPN press releases. You agree?
Absolutely. That was the first thing that made me arch my eyebrows.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing too, was in my conversation with Erica Nardini, while she could not 100% say who killed the deal, I think she sort of spelled it out, basically saying, like, you know, you read their statement. It seemed very clear that, you know, in the end, it ultimately came from the highest levels with regard to who made it. And to quote her, I'm assuming that because the statement came from John Skipper, I would say it came from him. This is interesting in that, John, as we sort of finish up here, do you see this as Skipper getting more involved in these kind of things? Obviously, he has a big company to run with a lot of issues and a lot of, obviously, strengths and some weaknesses. But are we going to see Skipper take more of a, you know, like a line item kind of role in some of this stuff? Because, you know, maybe a year or 2 years ago, you know, Skipper obviously signs off, but the people we're hearing from externally are the Connor Shells and the Burke Magnuses.
Yeah, and you know, they just gave Connor Schell a big promotion to get where he is, and they trust Connor Schell, and they think that you know, he has a good sense of things. I think that there was a difference of opinion on this one, on Barstool, but I think Connor still has a lot of juice over there, and you know, it's collaborative. But you know, Connor runs the you know, production group over there. Burke runs the programming group. They report to John Skipper. John Skipper comes from that area, so he's more knowledgeable about it than he is, say, you know, cable affiliate sales. But that, you know, I don't take this as John Skipper's going to all of a sudden come in and start doing, you know, line item vetoes, like you say. I think that this was something that he knew was going to create a lot of press. I mean, we're still talking about it 2 weeks after the fact.
Right.
And so he, you know, that was one of the reasons that he came out with a statement like he did.
All right, last thing for me, and obviously one of the biggest things for Connor Schell, if not the biggest thing coming up for him in the next 6 months, is the Mike Greenberg project. That for Connor Schell early on will be a very big statement about his sense of content and the success or non-success of that show. Obviously, Connor Schell has a lot of success in his pocket with 30 for 30 and obviously behind the incredible OJ documentary. That's the best thing ESPN's ever done, in my opinion, on any platform. So that's where his sort of base is. John, in terms of Barstool, Erica Nardini told me that she would consider shopping this show elsewhere, which I found interesting. I believe there are other entities, specifically FS1, who absolutely would deal with Barstool. You know, there's a lot of stuff about Fox I don't particularly like, but one of the things I really, really like about Fox is that they are not as bothered by external press, by social media, the way ESPN is. You know, if they hire something, listen, well, everybody who listens to this podcast knows full well what I think of people like Skip Bayless and what I think of those who, you know, try to race bait on like opinion. I'm not saying Bayless is, but you know, who sort of use like kind of racial animus to do sports talk programming. But Fox stays the course when anything is negative on them. They're going to go into deals with people and they're going to stay with those deals no matter what the press says. To me, I don't think a lot of Barstool's negatives would bother Fox if they thought that the investment in getting the 18 to 34 year old male market is worth it. Do you see a Barstool Van Talk maybe heading elsewhere? Because I actually think it would be an interesting fit and a good fit on FS1.
I think there's a possibility of it. I think Fox is the most logical one. CBS would never do it.
No chance.
I doubt that NBC would want to get involved. Turner maybe on Bleacher could be interested in that, but certainly not
Comedy Central, Spike TV. By the way, we should note, though, that Michael Davies, who was the executive producer of this Barstool Van Tuck show, it does have a relationship with NBC regarding Men in Blazers. And so, you know, maybe it's not impossible NBC Sports would do it. And I know for sure that NBC Sports had been talking to Barstool in the past about different stuff. But FS1 just strikes me as, like, if this would ever work, the fit. Because they just, in a way, to their credit, they don't care about listening to... You know, it's not Disney, and the things that are important to John Skipper and Disney are not as important to News Corp, 21st Century Fox, Rupert Murdoch, et cetera.
Yeah, but the, you know, the stuff that scared John Skipper, that would terrify Comcast, which owns NBC. So I could see them going to FS1. The question is whether or not you know, Barstool wants to do that, or whether they want to sort of build up its own, you know, its own brand. But the thing that that Burke Magnus and Connor Schell loved about Barstool Van Talk is just the type of audience that all of a sudden came to ESPN2, which was, you know, people will pay for that. So I do think that there is something that's out there for Barstool Van Talk if it wants to shop itself out to another network.
Wait, John, ESPN2 still exists? Didn't they move all their shows to ESPN? Is that network still around?
And they canceled the other one, exactly.
Right, exactly. All right, John Oran has been the guest from the Sports Business Daily and Journal. I kept him longer than I said I would. Listen, John, you know, really, really interesting reporting. You just got stuff in this deal that no one else got within ESPN circles, and particularly... I think it was eye-opening for anybody who read it to see that you were privy to Sam Ponder's agent letting the highest levels of ESPN know that this was coming. That was fascinating to me. I had not read that or seen that. So I appreciate your reporting on this. And you will definitely be back on the Sports Illustrated Media Roundtable, you know, with either Chad Finn or Jimmy Traina or Andrew Buchholz or Jim Miller.
Is Traina slumming for this? Well, he has his own podcast.
I know. Do you have a preference if I'm going to put you on, who you want to be? Maybe. What about Austin Karp one of these days to do maybe more of a rating-centric roundtable?
Austin would be great on that, actually.
Yeah, that's, by the way, I've mentioned Austin Karp many, many times. At Austin Karp, if you want objective sports television ratings, data, details, he's not like me throwing out sort of my own asides about stuff. He's very, very sort of agnostic to the data, which I appreciate, and that is John's longtime colleague. All right, John, listen, enjoy Maryland basketball coming up.
You know what? We're going to be sneaky good in the Big Ten this year.
I think you're right about that. Might be a little bit of a down year for the women, though, by the way. Brenda Freeze losing a couple of really good starters, but Maryland always reloads in women's basketball, so don't be alarmed there, John. You'll be back in the top 10, if not this year, next year.
Oh, I have trust in Brenda.
Definitely. In Brenda we trust, exactly. All right, John, thank you very much.
Hey, anytime, Richard. Thanks.
See you, John. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Marty Smith of ESPN. Really enjoyed that conversation. And John Orand for his insight on the dissolution of ESPN and Barstool Sports' partnership. Previous podcast guests, Kim Martin and Chad Millman. Check that out. Kim Martin heading to the Post to cover the Redskins. Chad Millman at the Chernin Group to do sports gambling content as far as the head of media for their Action Network. We got some sports media roundtables that you can check out in addition to ESPN basketball analyst Doris Burke. Please head to the SI Media Podcast with Richard Deitch page on Apple Podcasts. Sign up. Give us a review. We really appreciate people listening on there, on Stitcher, on Google Play. But the right now, 5-star rating. So I cannot thank you guys enough. You really have supported this podcast, and it's appreciated. I appreciate it as I stumble on my words. My podcast producer is Lou Pellegrino. He does an awesome job. Thanks to Cadence 13 and to Sports Illustrated. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.